So much of Amelia Earhart's story lives in the spaces between the facts. The hours unaccounted for, the voices never heard again, the whispers of survival. Those unanswered questions keep us chasing, keep us listening for what might still be found. Over this rebrand, we've traced radio logs, scoured sonar scans off remote atolls, and sat with the experts who have watched the world collectively hold its breath since July of 1937. We've pushed beyond accepted timelines, challenged the orthodox accounts. Each step has carried us further from the airport in Oakland and closer to the moment when time itself seemed to slip through Amelia's fingers. But tonight is not about that. Tonight we shift our focus, not to new sonar anomalies or grid searches, but to the power of storytelling itself and the woman who champions it. Tonight we welcome a guest whose entire career has orbited around truth-telling. She's a journalist, writer, and documentarian. Someone who has long been fascinated by how stories shape us and how we shape them in turn. Her work spans genres, subjects, and decades. Whether she's exploring women's inner lives or investigating hidden stories, tonight's guest has a lens that's always clear and always curious. In her new book, she turns her attention to reckoning with the unknown, not in search of wreckage or coordinates, but to dig into the emotional fallout, the cultural aftershocks that reverberate long after an airplane ever disappears. She's been asking questions like, how do you grieve someone you never knew? How does a myth persist when facts remain elusive? Over this last season, we've heard from explorers, navigators, forensic experts, all alike. We've tracked timelines, reevaluated eyewitness accounts, and examined cryptic newspaper clippings reeking of both desperation and hope. All the while, we felt the pull of Earhart's silhouette, her strength, her ambition, her solitude, and the void she left behind. Tonight's conversation allows us to step backward. We step into the stories left untold, letters never sent home, journals never written, and an echo of words like we're running low, drifting in static. We'll talk about the morality, myth-making, and the memory, about how the flight of one aviatrix became a collective heartbeat for generations to come. Tonight's guest has a journey that might just teach us more about our own need to chase, to connect, to understand, maybe to grieve. It's part reflection, part excavation. But we're not chasing debris this time. We're chasing meaning. So whether you've been with us since the very first broadcast, or this is your first descent into Earhart's world, stay with me, because there are stories that don't end in a disappearance. They begin to live anew, in the telling. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From New York City, this is Lori Gwynn Shapiro. And we are live. Lori, it has been a very long time coming for this. Thank you for coming to the show. Welcome to Chasing Earhart.
I am so delighted. I know that you were one of the many people that I interviewed during the journey of this book, but now it's finally coming to fruition this July.
Yes, it's been a long road for you. And the aviator and the showman, Amelia Earhart, George Putnam, and the marriage that made an American icon certainly don't agree with that statement. Let's get into it. I'm going to ask you the first two questions I've asked every guest that's ever sat in that chair since the beginning of this.
Got it.
It's a two-part question. Prior to the book, because I know, obviously, you've been writing for a long time, you're an author, you've been doing a lot of stuff. Give me a little bit about your education, your professional background leading up to Amelia Earhart entering your life, and then we'll get into all that after.
Okay, well, I have been writing for many years, and I've also have a documentary background, and I'm a trained journalist. I'm actually also a professor of journalism at NYU. So I really came to this story as a journalist more than an aviator or an Amelia Earhart fan. Although, as I say in my author intro, the very first biography I ever read was a Scholastic book that I ordered on Amelia Earhart, and I still have the copy on my shelf with my child's handwriting.
Wow.
But my real connection to Amelia Earhart came from my last nonfiction book, The Stowaway, which was with another publisher, which was about a young man who journeyed to Antarctica in 1928, swam across the Hudson River, and was eventually used in the publicity for Admiral Byrd's first expedition of Antarctica. Now, Admiral Byrd's publisher happened to be George Palmer Putnam,
That's right.
who was also Amelia Earhart's publisher and who was also Charles Lindbergh's publisher. He was the publisher to Adventurers. Now, he was not, as many people make this mistake, the head of his family firm. There was a game of succession going on. There were five nephews vying to take over. The person who was the head of Putnam in the Jazz Age was a man who had kind of risen during the Civil War years, George Haven Putnam.
Yeah.
And that's one of the major challenges in writing this book. There are so many Putnams to keep track of. So I ended up calling him George, just so you know who you were talking to about.
Yeah.
But George Palmer Putnam was named after his grandfather, who was George Palmer Putnam. My actual in to this story, believe it or not, was not Amelia Earhart. It was her husband, because I wondered what kind of guy would do a contest. I actually went to Antarctica for this book for research. I go all in, as you know.
Yeah.
And it's really dangerous. And we were not doing the tourist track. I mean, I went where the explorers went, which is down by the Ross Sea. And even someone on my trip was had a heart attack who was pretty young. I mean, it is
Jesus.
not a joke. What kind of person did a contest for all the Boy Scouts in America, which was at that time 800,000, which would be a great audience builder, to send a kid to Antarctica? And I always wondered about that. And I realized that in the end, it was the same person who kind of signed on for lots of dangerous expeditions without any sort of mea culpa when things went wrong.
Yeah, that's a great segue into the epigraph of the book. He posted it on Instagram not too long ago, and you have a few quotes in there, one from Earhart, which is a very well-known one, but the one I'm really interested in is Harry Truman's quote, which is a very well-known quote as well, especially if you're a Harry Truman guy or if you're a presidential historian or you're into that kind of thing. But I'm going to read the quote, and the quote goes, quote, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know," end quote. And that's, of course, from Harry S. Truman. Let's start with that, because one of the big reasons why a lot of people are so excited for this book is, one, you're really sort of diving into the relationship, and which is really foundational, right, for what made Earhart Earhart. And there is another person in that relationship that really helped shape that. To start tonight, really, I know you've leaned on and discovered some previously unresourced material to sort of write and craft this book. I won't ask you to give away your sources, of course, but I will ask you to tell me a little bit about when you first came across the material and sort of what your first thoughts were once you sort of consumed it for the first time. Did you think like, holy shit, this is insane?
Yeah, it came in layers, and then I had hints of other archives that I was chasing. This is the right podcast to use that word. But I started when I signed my book contract, which was November of 2019, and now we're talking in 2025.
Wow.
So this was not a short research project. I did what many people do when they start looking at the world of Amelia Earhart. I immediately flew to Purdue University, where the bulk of Amelia Earhart archives are. They've been picked over to a great extent. They were donated by George when he got into his third marriage
Yeah.
of four marriages. I think also there's a lot, it was a painting of Amelia as well there that was given. His new wife, who was in her young 20s, did not want any of that stuff around. It was sort of having a ghost in the house. Also, it raised money, to be able to give away. I mean, he had a book sale of Amelia's,
Yeah.
this was again, remember when Amelia died, we were still in the Great Depression
Yeah.
and money was needed. But one thing that since the last big biographies, and I would call my book narrative nonfiction, if you're a David Grant fan, if you like Killers of the Flower Moon or
Yeah.
The Wager or a Patrick Radden Keith fan. I'm a storyteller, but everything is deeply researched. So this is not a traditional cradle to grave biography. This book really starts where the action is. It's a story. We go back in time, but it really starts when Amelia and George meet. Everything that's in this book, including dialogue, which a lot of biographies don't use, is sourced from tapes, from interviews. I don't make up anyone's thoughts. And there is a very extensive bibliography and notes in the back. So anyone who questions where I got something from, they can find it.
Yeah.
That's a very important part of research. It's not just coming up with ideas, it's actually proving where you got them from. But I will say the last big traditional biographies came out when Amelia's 100th birthday was happening, which was around 1997. And the movie Amelia, which was directed by Mira Nair, took two of the biographies and put them together,
Yeah.
taking, I would say, some true information and some false information from both. There was other books that had come before. So since that publication, there has been donations by the Putnam family of many new archives that haven't been used in a very major biography.
Yeah.
So that was what I needed to do. I was there for about a week and really went through everything. And then I flew to Boston, where another big chunk of Amelia's stuff is, and I needed to know all the stuff. I don't rely on other people's books. I have to look at things myself.
Yeah.
I see a lot of mistakes in biographies that is, you could see where the mistake is, and then it just gets repeated and repeated again by the next biographer because they didn't put their eyes on original documents. And in Boston was where Muriel, Amelia's sister, gave a lot of her archives.
Right.
That's why it's in Radcliffe, which is now part of Harvard. So those were my first stomping grounds.
Yeah.
And I was overwhelmed. As you know, Chris, there's a gazillion pages of material and video and audio and everything about Amelia Earhart.
Yeah.
And I needed to make sure, now that I signed my contract, I got to deliver.
Right.
What did I have to say that was new? The next thing I did was I tried to track down all of the biographers who were still living. And this is a very unusual move. And interview them because a lot of people published before the internet was very common or social times had changed. And I wanted to see if I was missing anything.
Yeah.
Was this a sham marriage?
Yeah.
What was her sexuality? People thought of her as a pilot. What could they say and not say? I also contacted the people that put on the American Experience documentary, and I'm a former filmmaker myself. So I knew to interview the producer, the director, and the editor separately because not everybody always gets along after a documentary. You get all the perspectives, right?
Yeah.
And I kept asking one question. Was there anything you weren't allowed to say? Was there any pressure that you were getting?
Right.
And all the time, I was getting pretty much the same answer, which was that they weren't hiding anything about her relationships, which was very interesting because if I miss that, I miss a lot of her interior life,
Yeah.
you know? But at the same time, the other thing was that there was pressure, especially, for example, at PBS to not put negative things about George in or other issues like that. Families are not always the best source of legacy. Think about anyone in your family that might be a yeller or a screamer or done worse. You wouldn't actually want to go on record and say that about that person.
Right.
That doesn't mean that they're completely evil either. You know, people are not black and white. And I realized that not telling the story that a family wants necessarily is good journalism.
Yeah.
It's not going to make every person in a family happy, but I'm not writing a puff piece,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
My only objective, Chris, was to tell the truth. As you read with the Harry Truman piece, I'm a journalist. I don't make things up. If I don't find it, I don't create my source.
Yeah.
I don't put things out that before I found backup for it. And in fact, the other thing is this is published with Viking, which is part of Penguin Putnam. And on top of everything else, it has to go through a legal review. So you can't make things up.
Right.
Everything that I read and wrote eventually about had to be put down. Where did I get that from? Where was my source? So that's what I feel so confident about this book is that if I said there was something in a file, it's not that I just said there's something in a file. I can tell you where that file is and you can go look at it yourself,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, and several questions come up as you're talking about that, really just more expansion questions. It's interesting for me personally, and I have a stake in this, obviously. I'm very invested in this case and the story and the legacy more than anything. You talk about being a journalist and sort of doing your job when it comes to telling the story and speaking the truth. I got two questions here. The first one, I guess, is before you take this step, and you write something that will impact the legacy of not one, but several people potentially. Do you have to do any soul searching before you do that? Or is this something that you just look at as, look, it's black and white, it's a job, I want to do it right, I want to do it correct, and I want to do it justice?
This is a really fascinating question to me because I like Amelia Earhart and I've spent 5 years with her. I know people who have done other, I have a lot of friends who are journalists and biographers, and sometimes they finish their book project and they don't like the person they just wrote about. Careful who your heroes are. I was terrified the whole time that I was going to find out really, really, really ugly things about her. The thing is, though, to me, I'm a mom. I'm a wife, I'm a friend to people. I'm not perfect, and I'm sure you're not perfect. And Amelia Earhart has almost always been presented as someone who doesn't curse, who doesn't smoke, doesn't even drink coffee. She's like this angel. And that's not the way women are. You have to be very ambitious to do the things that she did. Ambition was not quite palatable to many people when it comes to a woman involved. How was that recast? Legacies are smoothed over. Someone that did very nasty things, that doesn't always fit a good narrative, particularly, say, for a film. Or sometimes people want something more from a character. In this case, we can talk a little bit about Eugene Vidal, who has brought out in other biographies as Amelia's lover. That is something that I also question as well in this book. I mean, the source for that was Gore Vidal, who was a young boy when he knew Amelia Earhart. He's also someone who's an incredible fiction writer, but is a known fantasist. And I eventually was able to find documents from way back that just really talk about Amelia's relationship with his father, that he changes every 5 years. He did an essay that got a lot of hits and he kept increasing it. And one of the people I interviewed was his own biographer, who was laughing about how, he's a great storyteller. But sometimes, that makes great copy and gets you in the press. As you know, in Amelia Earhart land, sometimes if you have the greatest story, you're on the front page of the paper. And that's not always truth.
I think it's a matter in this case, and of course I won't speak for everyone, but I think it's a matter of when it comes to the ending, and we're going to kind of jump around here, but when it comes to the ending and the answer to the mystery, right, and the answer to what happened to her and Fred Noonan in July of 37,
Sure.
I feel like everybody wants so badly to be the one to sort of end this and put a period on the sentence that they're willing to sort of forego morality a little bit and sort of, throw these claims out there here and there that are pretty big earth-shattering claims with not a lot of backing, not a lot of backup for those claims. And I think that's one of the things over the last 4 decades, probably at least, that has really tainted the case and has really tainted, in some ways, the legacy a little bit. So I think a book like yours coming out at this time, at this moment, exploring a massive aspect to Amelia Earhart's life, I think is warranted, it's needed. And my question, or my second question, really was, you mentioned earlier, when you signed your contract and you agreed to do this book, you needed to make sure that you could deliver something new,
Right.
right? Something that hasn't been done before. Were you worried that you couldn't deliver something new?
At first, I was. I'll be really honest about my process because they took a great leap of faith in me. When you do a nonfiction book with one of the big five publishers, they give you an advance. Now, if you don't deliver the book, you have to give that back. And that's happened to friends of mine where they've gone and spent, paid off college bills, and all of a sudden they have to give it back. Also, you don't have to give it back if the book bombs. As long as you deliver something. Normally, I'm a very, very fast writer, but I really wanted to understand the story. Another thing was going on, which was what happens in March 2020? We have the pandemic. Research is very difficult at this period of time. If anyone's a researcher here, if you ever do a book deal, the first thing you do is you go to the major archives, get that over with, get that research done. Don't dally. I had gone to Indiana and I had gone to Boston, but I started to look at other archives that people may or may not have looked at. And one of my first breakthroughs came in March of 2020, a couple of days after the pandemic was really worrying everybody. Are these libraries, they open? And I will say, like 2 days after the library that I went to, where I found some startlingly revealing documents, shut down.
No.
It was just the nick of time. So I had that by March of 2020. And that included another source who was really one of the people on the inside who was not included in any biographies. Things that have been included by him have been watered down, taken out. He became an enemy of Putnam at the very end. But this is a person who is a very prestigious person in American history as well. I could tell you because this is going to be airing in July, right?
Right, yeah, as it releases, so that way, yeah, that way we can, if you dump something
I mean,
here, it won't be premature, I promise.
one of the major people was like real insider information from Hilton Rayleigh.
Yeah.
He was there. And if you know anything about Hilton Rayleigh, he was an undercover person. That's how he met George Putnam. That gets left out of the story. They were both undercover before he met Amelia.
Yeah.
Putnam had two lives. He was a publishing, a rising publishing star, but he was also working undercover, which you'll find about out in my book.
Yeah.
But then Hilton Rayleigh is one of the great, interesting figures of American history because in World War II, he leads what is called the Ghost Army, which was using PR techniques to fool the enemy, like painted tanks that were made out of cardboard or audio that the enemy thinks that we're nearby. So this is, of course, after Amelia Earhart is dead in the 1940s, but he never talked about the Ghost Army, and it's just coming out now. They're all getting the Medal of Honor. So this is a person who really could keep his mouth shut. That wasn't my biggest score.
We'll get there, I promise. For Rayleigh, if I remember correctly, he was the one that sort of recommended Earhart to Putnam, no? When he was looking to replace Amy Guest on the flight?
Yeah, I mean, you see this problem in a lot of the bios. Like, if you've ever been in a creative endeavor, I'm sure this has happened to many of the listeners, where someone says, hey, that was my idea. No, that was my idea. It gets silly. Hilton Rayleigh never did that. A lot of things that came about was him working behind the scenes. He ran a very, very big PR firm during the Jazz Age, and the projects that he's known for, including Byrd's Antarctica expedition that my last book was about, and being involved with Amelia Earhart, which he didn't charge her any money for, they were just fun. They were larks. He had this very fun love-hate relationship with Putnam, but they were buddies. They had been undercover agents together. That's something you're going to find out in my book.
Yeah,
Isn't that exciting?
it is.
They
Yes.
had a very strange relationship. The thing about Rayleigh is that he didn't talk about his endeavors, where Putnam did,
Yeah.
and say, this was my idea. Sometimes it's good to have someone just claiming that, a public face, which is part of the story. I would say, really, the end of my first year of research, there were a lot of errors in some of the biographies that were not. Names were the wrong names. People that said, I didn't meet this person until a year later were coming up. And I realized that a lot of information on biographies gets passed down from other biographies and not from original documents and original research.
Yeah.
One of the things you have to do is find people who are alive as well as documents. So that was another plan of attack. I did get to interview, and I know she was on your show, Amelia's niece before she passed away.
Yeah.
There was maybe three people that I interviewed that had met Amelia Earhart, but they really met her when they were kids,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
What I realized is that there was another part of the story that people don't know about, which were these children, these kid explorers. And people may know that George's son, David Binney Putnam, was a child star in the 20s. His father made him into a bestseller by sending him on adventures. It was sort of a guinea pig for an idea he had. It was very popular for young novel writers to be 11 or 12. And he thought, what if we make boys doing the adventures? And he started to send kids, at first they were boys, on these very, very wild, dangerous adventures.
Yeah.
I was trying to show a pattern. They had to sign releases. The families needed the money. They had to sign releases that Putnam and then another publisher that he worked for was not responsible.
Yeah.
And they drummed up tremendous publicity. But I'm a mom of a 22-year-old, but I'm not, teenage years are not so far behind me. I would be very concerned about sending kids to Africa where they have to shoot lions or go near volcanoes. And I mean, there were really unbelievable adventures. And then when Amelia comes on the scene, there's girls that are also being sent on very wild adventures, very, very young. And one of the things that I realized is that the kid explorers have not really been in the story, but they were children and their children are definitely alive. And I tracked down a lot of these kids who are now, when I say kids, they're now in their 60s and 70s. These were the children of the kid explorers. And they got contracts and stories about what their parents, their grandparents were talked into. So that was another level of showing that there was a sort of a cavalier attitude. At the same time, you can't judge the past by today's standards. I will say on top of that, there weren't other publishers that were doing what Putnam was doing. He was really courting danger throughout his whole career. I don't hate him. He's could be very dynamic, but then there was another part of the legacy that wasn't really touched upon, which was the other women pilots of the time and how careers were quashed. That's a real mystery for me still. I found quite a bit of evidence about this. There were people like Lady Heath and Eleanor Smith. I spoke to people who thought that Eleanor Smith was lying, and I really researched the heck out of her, and she was not at all lying. Everything she ever said was adding up. Her daughter is alive, which is an incredible source, in her 90s. Hopefully, she'll be at my launch. But I wouldn't call George Putnam someone like a Harvey Weinstein. That's not who he is. I don't know if you ever heard of Scott Rudin. I mean, he was more like a Scott Rudin. He did not like anyone crossing him, and he would do whatever he could to quash the enemy, even if it was a 16-year-old kid like Eleanor Smith, who was, to many people's minds, the better pilot of the early part of Amelia Earhart's career. Now, here's the thing about Amelia Earhart that I really wondered about. How good of a pilot was she? As anyone that could go across the Atlantic by themselves, right? You're not a bad pilot. Let's just like you try that, you know, like let's just get that out of the way. However, were there other pilots who were better? Was she, as you probably know, was she so busy doing a grueling publicity detail, a tour that she wasn't getting her actual flight practice in, which exhausted. She also was not a very well person. She had a lot of physical ailments. And you have to remember the other character, and I say character because this is nonfiction, but hopefully it feels like a novel or feels like an HBO film. And I've been told it's very cinematic, but the other character in this book is the Great Depression. You cannot tell the story of Amelia Earhart without talking about how in 1928 we're in the jazz age, and within a few years, Dorothy Binney Putnam, who was George's wife and the Creole or crayon heiress, is divorced from him. He tried to get back together after the stock market crash and she was not having it. Then he was pushed out of his own publishing firm by his uncle. He did not win the legacy game. He did not win the game of secession. And he briefly went to a very small publisher, which was kind of something to put in the papers, but he really didn't have any money. He was flat broke. What he did have was his relationship with Amelia Earhart. And that's when the story really shifts for me. Was this relationship real in the beginning? Absolutely. This wasn't a fake marriage. I mean, eventually, as you read, there were other archives that were found all over the country. I eventually went on a chase and found one major university had no idea what they had. I went through it, and now I think they're going to be putting their stuff online and searchable, and you can visit. There were off-record interviews. I listened to tapes of people. I mean, really, like once you get past Purdue and Boston documents, now you're in business because those have been gone through, right?
Extensively,
They've been curated by descendants or relatives. So Muriel took out a lot of stuff in Boston, and the Putnam family, like you don't see some of the stuff that is in my book, which is not flattering. There's also the George Putnam Archives at Purdue as well, which is a separate
Right.
collection. They're not in there either.
Right.
And would you, if you were in charge of your family's legacy, would you put in the nasty stuff?
Yeah, no, you'd want
Yeah, you would curate it, right?
to. I agree with that. And I, as you're talking, questions galore come up. I just want to ask you. I feel like this conversation can go 4 hours and go all night, really. You mentioned Earhart and Putnam sort of shaping a public persona. Would you consider that Amelia was an active participant in shaping her own brand, or do you think that Putnam was just driving it all the way home and she wasn't really participating as much as history has led folks to believe?
I think that that is one of the most interesting things that I uncovered. Amelia was super ambitious. That is something that, as a woman, I recognize that being an ambitious woman is not always palatable.
Yeah.
Before she even met George Palmer Putnam, and I went through archives in New Jersey, she was an ardent feminist.
Yeah.
She was in the most one of the most extreme feminist organizations. What happens in the 1920s is that the word feminist becomes politicized primarily through Henry Ford. So if you think about this, when did women get the vote in America? It's 1920. It was pretty okay to be a suffragette at that point,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
By the mid-20s, being a feminist is an incredibly divisive word, and there's factions of feminism, and it becomes a little nerve-wracking to say you're a feminist, even if 5 years earlier you were marching in parades. You have to understand the political climate of the Jazz Age. So what Putnam did, one part of his story that's always been told that he's a master PR guy is true. He taught her how to seem less ambitious. And we get this story that she's incredibly modest. And yeah, I mean, that's not totally a lie, but she is driving a lot. And they may, and here's where the evidence gets a little bit nerve-wracking, is that she knows that the way to make money is through this lecture circuit.
Yeah.
Before the stock market crash, here's another thing that people don't know, is that she had boyfriends in between the time she had an affair with Putnam and the time she gets married to him.
Yeah.
I was able to locate who those boyfriends were. So she was at that time a millionaire.
Yeah.
She was greatly affected by the stock market crash.
Yeah.
She was a woman about town. She was an eligible bachelorette. Whether she was still getting it on with George is debatable. But after the stock market crash, they really need each other. Her father also passes away and does not leave her any money, not that she expected any money.
Yeah.
As you probably know, he was an alcoholic and
Yeah.
he joined the Christian Scientists out in California. She also was swindled by a good chunk of her money. There were a lot of swindlers in the. Doesn't that sound like a real Jazz Age thing?
It definitely fits the time for sure, that word. Yes.
But, I think she also enjoyed George Putnam. I think that part of the narrative that we've heard is he was funny.
Yeah.
You know, he could be very funny, very smart. He could be very cruel to people that got in his way. And he needed Amelia Earhart. I think that he was much crueler to her as the years went on, as quite a bit of evidence shows. But she also distanced herself during periods of the marriage. Now, I believe you're married, correct?
I am.
Yeah, and I'm married. I've been with my husband. We were together for 7 years before we got married, and then been married for many years. Marriages get hot and cold themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, that is part of the story, that if you expect a perfect marriage, what kind of fantasy land are you living in?
Yeah.
So there's moments of time where they're very, very close. There are moments and times where they're living on different sides of the country,
Yeah.
and they're still technically married. The story of Amelia Earhart and George is really just a 9-year story.
Yeah, it's very short. Yeah, like her flight career is very short, really, when, in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, they meet in 28 and she's
Gone in 37.
37, so it is over.
Yeah.
One of the things about this book, which some people, I call it narrative nonfiction, but some people are calling it a double biography, is my book doesn't end when she is gone.
Yeah.
We keep going with George. And again, money is an issue. They were going to be very, very wealthy if Amelia had completed that flight.
Yeah.
And that is the difference of the 1937 flight from the 1932 flight, which she really wanted to do. She did not like having been known as the passenger in 28. That was a flight that she really wanted to make. There's other flights that I think she was very proud of, but I think that that last flight was really to make money, to get to have a retirement. There was actually a film that was going to be made after she got back. There was, as you know, this stuff, there were tons of contracts. But when she disappeared, all of that was lost. And George Putnam had a lot of bills to pay. And that's where it gets a little sordid.
We'll expand on that as much as we can here in a minute. I want to talk about something that is a very well known in Earhart lore and Earhart history, and I want to get your thoughts on it.
Sure.
I'm going to read it verbatim here in a moment, but I want to talk about the letter that Earhart writes to George Putnam
Sure.
on the morning of their wedding. Actually, I think exactly a year, almost a year to the day for the world flight. And I want to read the letter. And I have a couple of questions. I want to just ask you about it and kind of get your opinion on it.
I write about the letter, so this is right up my alley.
Awesome. Okay. Well, here is the letter verbatim, and we will link it in the show's notes tonight for folks who want to read it themselves. It starts, "Dear GPP, George Palmer Putnam," which is what she sort of lovingly referred to him as, "there are some things which should be writ before we are married, things we have talked over before, most of them. You must know again my reluctance to marry, my feeling that I shatter thereby chances and work which means most to me. I feel the move just now as foolish as anything I could do. I know there are many compensations, but I have no heart to look ahead. In our life together, I want you to understand, I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. If we can be honest, I think the difficulties which arise may best be avoided should you or I become interested deeply or in passing in anyone else. Please let us not interfere with the other's work or play, nor let the world see our private joys or disagreements. In this connection, I may have to keep some place where I can go to be myself now and then, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all times the confinements of even an attractive cage. I must exact a cruel promise, and that is, you will let me go in a year if we find no happiness together. I will try to do my very best in every way to give you that part of me you know and seem to want." Two questions on this. If people read this now, I don't know that it's so unconventional, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm sort of clocked out here. How unconventional was this marriage, this arrangement, whatever you want to call it? And really, how brilliant was this step by Earhart to write this letter prior to the marriage and basically lay out, her real raw feelings to a man who she felt could handle it?
Okay, before I get to your questions, this letter has George's hand all over it. You need to know this. The letter was first published in a ghost-written book after her death when he was involved with another woman already. And he had created this almost character that she was always called AE, right? She didn't call him GP, she called him Chip. She signed her letters to him A. Like Amelia. And there's tons of text. It was typed up and it was edited by George. Passages were taken out, and the full letter is just as shocking, but is even more so. I think that that's one of the things that really intrigued me. Why was he changing her letter? A lot of the people that I spoke to said that they had created this persona of AE, but her friends and her family still called her Mealy or Amelia. George's closest confidants, I have this on tape as well, called him George. So you're starting to see the pattern here, okay? There is a great document at the heart of this, and then there's an edit. And that's sort of the story of Amelia and George, is that the whole story has been edited.
That's right.
But why would we be afraid of the truth? It doesn't make Amelia Earhart's bravery any less. And so you, one thing I say about George Putnam is whatever misgivings you have about how he treated other women pilots or his temper or the way he even treated Amelia, sometimes yelling at her at the end, which was documented by a number of people. We don't get women going to the moon without George Putnam. Amelia was doing great things, but she wasn't going to fly across the Atlantic. She wasn't going to be the inspiration to countless people, right? So there is this irony that this person who, really is so afraid of the truth of the story is actually the person that helps inspire many women, because we don't get the Amelia Earhart that we know, the AE, which is the way the film, had her always called AE. That was sort of not true. I mean, it was true to certain people that they were working with, but the intimate circle always called her Mealy or Amy, like it. But about that letter, you have to also remember the time. This was the jazz age. It was a very experimental time. It was a very, I mean, many of their friends were in open marriages. There are other people that they were talking to that were in open marriages. But to put it in writing like that is an extraordinary document. I think the other thing that she really wanted to be known as was Amelia Earhart. When she got married, the newspapers were calling her Mrs. Putnam. And she even wrote a letter, which I found in the New York, I live in New York City, so I was able to go to anything that was in New York was very easy for me. But in the New York Public Library, you can see letters to the Times in the New York Times archives where she's saying, "Hey, please don't call me Mrs. Putnam. I'm Amelia Earhart."
That's right.
I mean, she was a feminist. There's no other word for what she was. She was a very strong feminist, a word that by 1925 had become so ugly to many Americans through propaganda from Henry Ford that she even wrote a letter to one of her rivals in, I think it was 1927, saying, "I'm not a feminist, but," because you couldn't actually say it out loud. But I found interviews with her stepson, David Binney Putnam, which said she was the most feminist person I've ever met in my entire life. That's her own stepson. Also, it's very important to look at who George Palmer Putnam was. He was coming from a family of very strong women. His own mother, Frances, was a very strong woman, a feminist. His sisters were high achievers. His people in his family were among, there's a new biography out about a Putnam doctor who happens to be one of his aunts, I believe, one of the first women doctors in America. His brother, who was supposed to take over his role at Putnam Publishing, died in the last pandemic, which was the flu. And George was living on the West Coast. He came to the East Coast. But Robert was married to a very big feminist in New York. This was in the family. He was attracted to strong women. It was sexy.
Same.
This was jazzy. It was a sexy thing. I mean, after World War II, we went back to the, when the soldiers came home, we went back to sort of father knows best, right? That period of time in American history was charged with exploration. Do I think that she had other relationships? I think that she may have. You have to understand that George Palmer Putnam was married when he was involved with Amelia Earhart. But his wife had caught him in an affair, but she was also having her own relationships, which has been documented in another book by George's granddaughter. So what I'm saying is that there was a climate of exploration. There were certain things that just amazed me when Amelia and George and Dorothy Binney Putnam are all out together, not the period of time before she went across the Atlantic as a passenger, but after George was in a sexual relationship with her. And the other thing, that one of the things I discovered is that George and Dorothy owned a nightclub together, technically a dry nightclub, but not so much. But that was some of the scenes I had to cut. I toned it down, but like the rum running and getting the booze to the nightclub and pretending everything's dry. I mean, this was just a great period of time. Everything changes with the stock market crash. Everything changes. And that sort of jolly attitude is ushered away. And this is one of the reasons I was able to write this book, because my last book was the same period of time with Byrd's first expedition to Antarctica. I wrote about his stowaway, but when the men left for Antarctica in 1928, they were heroes, they were rock stars. While they were away on ice in Antarctica, the stock market crash happened. They came back in 1930 to a very different America. It's such a fascinating period of time. So that letter is written just after the stock market crash, but it's coming off of a decade of wild experimentation. And, Amelia Earhart was also living in New York for a period of time. She was moved from Boston down to New York to another social working job. so she could be closer to her lover, who happened to be George Palmer Putnam.
Huh.
This was a sexual relationship they were having.
Right.
But do I think that they found that first year of marriage was exciting? Yes. Now, remember, she was engaged to someone else.
That's right.
And that story is not also what it seems.
You're talking about Sam Chapman, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
Sam Chapman, I always wondered about that. How could you be engaged to somebody for 7 years? And there were other men while she was engaged to Sam Chapman.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found was, I'm sure you know her yellow car that she drove across from LA to Boston,
Yes.
which, the terrible racist name of the Yellow Peril from back in the day. You can't, from another period of time.
Yeah.
But the story always went, when they were sort of making up who Amelia Earhart was as a palatable figure for America, that she saved up, she had all these jobs, and then, but she had a sugar daddy in California who was very wealthy. I mean, she was ambitious. But is that so bad?
No.
Is that so bad for women to want to do things? There were no options for women to fly the way that men could, because men had the flight time from World War I. You had to have alternative measures. Now, we admire men that will scheme and get to the top, but what about women?
Yeah.
Is it so evil that Amelia Earhart was sometimes scheming to get things that she wanted in life? I mean,
No.
I find it just ambitious.
Right.
I happen to really like ambitious women.
It's not so far removed, really, from what we know historically about her. She was very ambitious. I think a book like this just sort of it digs its claws into the nuances of sort of that ambition and kind of what drove her as not only as a woman, but as someone that was in business for herself, that was promoting, women in aviation, promoting aviation in general. But I mean, just all of that weight that laid on her, I don't have an issue with her being ambitious. I think you probably would have had to have been. Yeah, it was cutthroat.
When she chose to go across the Atlantic in any of her flights, she might not have been the best pilot at the beginning. She did actually start studying, get up to snuff in many areas later on, but she didn't have the flight time.
Yeah.
She wanted money. She was a very broke social worker. I have the salary that she had,
Yeah.
from when she was working in Boston. And Sam, who she was involved with, as well as the other sugar daddy, who her parents wanted her to marry Sam, he was offering her a pretty good life, but he wanted her to be a Marblehead housewife. And she didn't want that for herself.
Wow.
Not that there's anything wrong with being a Marblehead housewife, it's just not what she
Right.
wanted, right?
Right.
And George basically said to her, stick with me. He started out as her manager. He remained her manager even when they were married, but stick with me and you'll make money. And by the end of the first summer of 1928, and again, this is before the stock market crash, she was a millionaire. She had
Wow.
fur
Yeah.
coats.
Well, let's talk a little bit about another aspect of, well, I guess it ties into the world flight a little bit now, because you're talking about the experience of the time in the middle of the Great Depression, the stock market collapse.
Right.
When she ground loops the aircraft in March of 37, and they have to change direction,
Right.
which of course changes the timing of the flight, which introduces headwinds potentially and some other issues that she might not have initially faced going the other direction. Do you think she was worried when she ground loops the aircraft and she has to figure out how to reassemble this aircraft and pull this flight off when so much, as you mentioned earlier, so much of her, the back half of her career and George's really, for that matter, depended on the success of the flight?
This is where getting access to tapes was really interesting to me,
Yeah.
because I could actually hear what people were saying who knew her. Many of the tapes were from long after Amelia was dead. Her good friends that were in the inner circle. I think that she wanted to wait to make the flight the next year in the same direction.
Yeah.
But George said, no, we go the other way. Go the other way. They were out of money. There was a whole flight manager that was hired on the Hawaiian flight, and he was no longer able to be in that role. And George takes over very deep aviation plans that he's not really that qualified to do. But Amelia is really his partner, his wife, but his business partner.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of pressure from him to go the other direction. But she wanted to do it. It's not like she's this innocent. That's the thing. It's not like George did this. Amelia and George did this together. They made these decisions together. She had tremendous advice, famously from Jackie Cochran, not to do it. I mean, I don't have to tell the listeners to this podcast that, you're looking at an island It's the size of Central Park in the middle of the Pacific, and with
Yeah.
clouds, it's very hard to find. And there's all sorts of people that are in my book talking about that. And who spoke to her beforehand? Do I think she was a little bit arrogant about this? I do.
Yeah.
She's a human being. I mean, people are not perfect. Do I think she had enough flight practice? I don't think so, because she had a very grueling schedule. However, I do think there were all sorts of issues on the final flight with the equipment, with the radio equipment.
Yeah.
I mean, as you probably know, she did not really know Morse code,
Right.
nor did Fred Noonan. Limited knowledge.
Yeah.
Also, there were a lot of witnesses to those final moments. And this is where I probably take issue with some of the other guests that have been on the podcast. I think it's very strongly clear that she ran out of gas.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing that I did discover, and this is going to be maybe the most controversial thing I say, Chris. Are
Yeah.
you ready for
Okay, let me brace myself. We're ready. Go for it.
that? I've been to Kansas, twice now. I'll be back probably when anyone's listening to this. I'll be in Atchison for
Yes, you will.
the Yard Festival.
Yes, you will.
Yeah, mysteries are good money. They're also good for towns, and people being told we don't know what happened to her brings tourism as well. That's one of the things that I think is really interesting. When you really dig in, and I know you have dug in, it's really clear that she didn't have any gas. You might take issue with me, but
I can see that for sure, of course.
is she going to then fly in the opposite direction? It's like, no. One of the things that I really come upon in my final days of research, which took me years to find it, I had to get to another set of archives that were hidden behind a door in Maine. And I sat
Jesus.
in a lock combination, and I sat on a floor for 9 hours looking at documents and tapes. And one of the things that's really amazing to me is how useful Amelia Earhart's death becomes later on. Because in the 1930s, there really wasn't that much question about what happened to her. But after World War II, she becomes very useful for propaganda.
She sure does.
And that is where I think a lot of the misgivings are. I think also some of the things that I discovered that I think you'll be really excited to see documents of are people that are so-called experts making discoveries on places like Saipan and paying for people to say things. I have cash checks. You got to follow
Jesus.
the money,
Yeah.
right? Really, the story changes, the culture changes in the 1960s. People are really into mysteries, and a lot of men start taking on Amelia's story. The first one to do it is a military man who is knows that his story is not correct, pays for his sources, and then that starts a whole slew of books that start to even hit the bestseller list
Yeah.
with made up information. One of the people I interviewed for my book, by the way, this is such a minor part of my book, but for anyone who's a Amelia Earhart buff, I don't know if you know who Wilbur Rothar is for 50 points.
Oh yes, I've heard the name. I've heard the name. Yes, this is going to be a good one.
Wilbur Rothar was someone who apparently had a scarf of Amelia Earhart's that, he was at sea.
That's right.
The FBI caught him, they entrapped him, and then they put him in a mental ward, and then he was missing. And a lot of the guys in the 1960s that, all the names, I'm sure you know all the names, started to say that, they would do codes to try to crack what that meant.
Yeah.
So one of the people that I interviewed was Wilbur Rothar's niece, grandniece. So
Jeez.
it's like, of course, it's like, of course he existed. It's like people are looking for the secret code of this name. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is that Muriel is so exasperated by what she sees as the BS that she starts to write her own book.
Yeah.
And a lot of what many of the later biographies come off of is this self, oh, it wasn't a self-publisher, but a small publisher that Muriel worked with, where she wrote a biography of her sister. It was actually ghostwritten as well.
Yeah.
Everything's ghostwritten in the story. But she was working with a friend, but she put very factual, she was an English teacher. She put lots of facts, and a lot of biographies where you see discoveries are basically not accrediting Muriel's work. But Muriel didn't get everything right. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting to me is that Muriel needed money. She was dead broke, and she never met George Putnam all the time that Amelia was with him. And she never knew George when Amelia was alive. And the end, he fires his ghostwriter, gets into a fight with her, and he needs Muriel because she can provide stories for his book that he has to. He's already spent the money on a book about Amelia that she was supposed to publish when she got back, but he actually publishes it after her death. But Muriel becomes very useful because she has lots of stories about childhood to flesh it out. But what George has that her husband is not giving her is money, like an advance. They have an unusual partnership. One of the things that was so shocking to me was I don't know that Muriel and Amelia got along very well at all during her marriage to George. They barely spoke to each other. Muriel never met George, but later on, she is very much his ally because he's also helping to pay her bills. So relationships are complicated, Chris. That doesn't mean that Amelia Earhart is any less brave to do the things that she did, that she's inspired any less people. But to me, I want to know who a person is. Like, I don't want to have a whitewashed biography. I want to know real people. I find real people interesting, and I hope you do too.
You mentioned some books that came out in the 60s. I guess Amelia Earhart Lives technically was published on January 1st of 1970, so we'll squeeze it into the 70s. But of course, Gerner's book, The Search for Amelia Earhart, which you sort of mentioned, 1966. That's when sort of the Japanese capture hypothesis, as we will call it here in this episode, started.
I found in the original archives just cash checks from supposedly, sources that, and arguing for more money. I mean, like, people that say, oh, they weren't paid for their quotes. And I think one of the things that was really interesting is that the publishers were saying, can't you spice this up a little bit? What I would tell all readers of this book is follow the money. It's not just people who might be conspiracy theorists. It's also Amelia Earhart. It's also George Palmer Putnam. It's also Muriel Earhart. Money is something that people need, and people do strange things for money. I mean, Amelia was someone who I think really loved Sam Chapman, by the way. They were friends up until he died. He was devastated when she was missing. And she saw him secretly as well, even after she was with Putnam. But I will say that she wanted a different life. And also, she had famously had a scrapbook of women that inspired her. She had in her boarding school in Ogance. And she would clip out women that were doing amazing things. And I don't think she wanted to have a regular life. I think if she had not met George Putnam, what I do think is that she would have risen the ranks as a social worker, because that was the path for a lot of women. We had a women's social worker, Frances Perkins, was in FDR's cabinet, the first woman in a cabinet. Social work was a way that women were rising, and she was becoming quite an executive in, she'd risen the ranks as sort of like a almost a temp, and she would fly over. She did know how to fly, and she flew up Boston, dropping pamphlets for the, events for the social work. And she was very good at organizing. She was very, very well spoken. She was a very smart person. She wanted to count. I think she would have become a social worker, is what I do think.
Yeah, I think so. My question, something that just popped into my head just now, why do you think she didn't, other than the money and maybe the seeing sort of what she needed to walk a path that she really, really wanted to walk. Why do you think she didn't marry Sam Chapman ultimately?
Because she had another lover who was giving her a lot of money. And the parents put the kibosh on that you'll have to read about that in my
All
book.
right, cut and dry. I like it. A couple more questions and then we'll wrap it. I don't want to get too, I want people to go out and get the book. That's the whole point of this this podcast.
Right.
I want to ask you about Putnam's relationships with the search efforts, both official and unofficial, whatever you can say. Did you uncover anything during your very long period of research time that discussed and kind of talked about George Putnam's involvement post loss of Earhart? And did anything surprise you there?
Yes.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. I don't even
I
think I'll ask you to expand.
think you're going to be shocked.
Yeah, go get the book, folks. Trust me, you're going to want to get this one and read it cover to cover.
I think that's a very startling section of my book, as a matter of fact. Your jaw
Oh,
might drop.
Jesus. All right. Well, you heard it here. If you haven't gotten it, this will be released as it comes out. But if you haven't gotten it, go pick it up.
Also on Kindle and an audio version, Viking has really pushed it. One thing about this book, though, I think if anyone's interested in how publishing worked in the 1920s, it's also a little of an inside look at that as well. And one thing I will say, I would describe the beginning days of Amelia Earhart's career as the first reality show. It really was. She was being cast. She was the all-American woman that they were looking for. I did interview descendants of Amy Guest as well. I interviewed Amy Guest's granddaughter, who's still very much alive. You don't have to just go off of documents. There's always someone alive that has a connection that, there's many rocks that have been unturned, even on a story so well trodden as Amelia Earhart.
Okay, I got another, I guess, a backdoor way into trying to probe on that last question, but I won't probe too much. I just will ask you, I think this is safe for you to talk about. You can tell me.
Okay.
Going back to sort of the George's involvement in the post loss of Earhart, how did he process his own grief losing Earhart in the way that he did? I imagine that would have been a massive shock for him. Maybe not. We'll have to wait for the book.
He did it through women. He was immediately dating. He was dating a stunt woman within weeks of Amelia's disappearance. I'm not saying that that's necessarily wrong. I mean, we can't judge grief. Do I think he was absolutely grieving? Yeah. But I think he probably felt a little bit of guilt as well, which he had to process. And he went through a number of women. Eventually, he goes on an expedition to find Amelia Earhart, which was really an excuse for him to go off with one of his girlfriends. And then he comes back and drops her and marries the woman who becomes his third wife. Now, that is something that is one part of the story. The other part of the story is that, again, Amelia becomes much more valuable after Pearl Harbor to propaganda purposes. One of the things that George does is he wants to have his cake and eat it too. He doesn't, to my mind, think that anything happened to Amelia Earhart, then she ran out of gas. I've actually seen the family Bible as well. I don't think there's anything there. I think, though, that he is in cahoots, and you'll have to read about with who, to claim to be offended when there's the film Flight for Freedom is being with Rosalind
That's
Russell,
right.
which is seen by a million soldiers, which is putting in their mind that an Amelia Earhart character is a spy, which is, that was fiction. That was a script that had been written before Amelia Earhart even died, right? But he also is getting money despite his protests, and he's getting money off of articles that are promoting that she was taken. It's really about the money, Chris. If you're broke and you're desperate, you do crazy things. And remember, he had a young wife who thought he was a millionaire publisher. He mistakenly thought that she was a very rich banking heiress, but she had stole her money. So
Oh, Jesus.
in the end, a lot of it comes down to money. Do I think he grieved? Of course. I don't think he was a total monster. I mean, there's very often a lot of people will lose a partner and be in a new relationship within months because you want to be held, you want to be kissed, So it's very hard to be too judgmental about that. But within weeks of Amelia Earhart disappearing, he was in a relationship with a woman, and then he discarded her for someone he thought had more money. He was an eligible bachelor. Remember, he was living at this point in time with his mother-in-law,
With Amy.
Amy, who did not like him, and he also wanted to get out of the house.
Jeez.
It makes a great story. For those of you who have always focused on how Amelia disappeared, which is, of course, one of the great stories in American history, that the other part of the story is just as fascinating. And I think that Amelia Earhart, one thing that people forget is during her period on Earth, after 1932, she was incredibly famous. And people knew her for her accomplishments, not for her death. I do think that they will find her plane at the bottom of the Pacific. That's my particular take, if you want to know.
Sure.
And I hope that that puts an end to that mystery. I know your show will have to end, but then maybe you can move. I wouldn't want
Yeah.
that,
Well, yeah, I
but
would say if you ask me, the show is far more about the legacy than anything else. And
right.
I have argued this for many years. Yeah.
I look forward to her
Me
legacy.
too.
But I think what's really interesting to me is that she's not a perfect person. I mean, you can see some of her politics are disturbing even in the 20s, but everybody's politics were disturbing in the 20s. What's the nicest thing I will give you about Amelia Earhart is that I did find other documents that show that she was really engaged with civil rights by the end of her life.
Yeah.
And I really admired that. I mean, not everyone in that aviation world was doing so. I mean,
Right.
one thing that we don't talk about a lot is that, we talk about the 99s, and I'm very connected to the 99s. I did a lot of research in Oklahoma as
Sure.
well.
Yeah.
I went out there, I went through the archives. But, when we talk about the women, the 99 women pilots, well, those were the 99 white women pilots. Black women pilots that were not allowed to join the 99s. I mean, times change, right?
Yeah.
And that is the thing. You cannot go into writing a history book and say, well, everything has to be understood through the lens of the year that you're living in. You have to look at what was everybody believing back then. But what you look for in a character development is what I found with Amelia Earhart is that she really evolved. One of the people that is very influential on her is Eleanor Roosevelt.
Sure.
Eleanor Roosevelt was a very good person, and that is something that really changes her. She's really connected. And also, one thing I would love to say about Amelia Earhart is she was a very big reader. I've actually looked at many of her books through various ways before they went to auction. I even was in her house in Rye, which is a private home, and there were still books there.
Jeez.
She was a big reader, and one of the things I loved was a very small clipping that said her favorite kind of books were biographies. So I hope
Wow.
I've done her proud. I hope she would
Yeah.
read this book.
Yeah. Can I ask you just a fun, I don't know if this will make the final recording, but I want to ask it anyway,
Sure.
because I think it's just a fun question. And I heard this a while back, and I don't know if it's true, so correct me, please. Is there any truth to the innuendo that floats around out there that Amelia Earhart was sort of the one that planted the seed or the idea or the whisper even of Social Security to FDR?
I will say that one of the great surprise sources for me was, of all places, in the Eisenhower Library.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
One of the reasons there are Amelia Earhart documents there is because they were placed there by Jackie Cochran, who was a Republican. One of the very, very interesting things about Amelia Earhart and George Palmer Putnam is that they had two different political parties. Imagine that in a house.
Yeah.
George had started out as a Democrat, but then he went to work for a Republican out west. He remains a Republican his entire life. Amelia Earhart was originally a member of the Women's Party. And in 1928, the Republican Party was supporting ERA. She was very big on ERA and probably voted with the Republican Party at that part. Herbert Hoover said he would support ERA.
Yeah.
Later on, she was campaigning for FDR. She was a pacifist.
Yeah.
It's very different. Charles Lindbergh was an isolationist. Amelia Earhart was a pacifist. That to me is a real mystery. Her politics are very to the left. Putnam's politics are to the right, but they were still married. I mean, we see that. I mean, I know families like that. I mean,
Yeah.
that makes for feisty conversations at dinner. But one thing that's really interesting is that Jackie Cochran has accounts of Amelia at her ranch talking about politics and her beliefs as well.
Yeah.
And really trying to convince congressmen that are local to be on the right of civil rights.
Yeah.
And she was someone who was very interested in Social Security. I think I found a couple of documents that will really surprise you in that area.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that one of the things that really is not answerable is she dies in 1937. And I say die because that's what I think happened
Yeah.
to her. But she was a pacifist. She was, because of her experiences as a nurse's aide in Toronto and seeing soldiers from World War I, she
Yeah.
became a pacifist. But what would have happened at Pearl Harbor? What would have happened? What role would she have had in World War II? She was against war. She was could be a member of the Daughters of Revolution because of her ancestry. But when she spoke in front of the Daughters of the Revolution, she was so against war. She said, women should be signed up, as a way, if you believe in war, let's get women to be signed up, which was shocking.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to go.
Right? I have no idea, and you can't make it up, what would have happened if she lived and we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, what role she would have had in
Right.
World War II.
Right.
Because she was against war in every shape and form. And I don't really know because people that were against war suddenly were on the side of the military.
Yeah, I think the one educated guess I could make is I think she certainly would have promoted the WASP, who were founded and created by Jackie Cochran or co-created by Jackie Cochran. I think she would have
Right.
definitely pushed for that, the inclusion of women as flyers for the war or for efforts that would maybe have nothing to do with the war, but just to get women into cockpits, military grade cockpits at the time. I think she probably would have used her face and probably would have used her reputation to help back that, especially for a good friend in Jackie Cochran at the time. I think she probably would have done that.
Well, the thing that's interesting is that I think that George Putnam, who did serve in World War I but never did any action other than stateside, his two children, George Jr. was in the Navy, I believe, and then his David Binney Putnam, who was taught to fly by Amelia, was in the Army Air Force. George signed up. He was at this point having difficulties with his young wife, and eventually he marries somebody that he met in the military who becomes wife number four. But he signs up in his 50s and he's involved with many theaters of war. He's and that's a really fascinating part of the story as well. He was a very active part of World War II and using his PR techniques. And Hilton Raley, of course, comes back into the story in World War II. I mean, it's hard to remember that these people were middle-aged then. They weren't old men, We meet them when they're so young at the beginning of the Amelia Earhart story. I mean, I'm much older than Amelia Earhart was at the beginning of her story, So that is something that I find really interesting because we look at a lot of people who were against having any kind of action at all. What would have Amelia Earhart done after Pearl Harbor? That's one of the questions that has fascinated me. And you can't make that up,
Yeah, you can speculate, but you can't. There's no way to know, of course.
But will the plane be found? I think so.
Yeah, I think so too.
And one of the things that's so interesting to me that I've been told, I've interviewed a lot of people who've been on various journeys over there, is that the thing that always, I think about is that the bones and teeth, if they find the plane, will have disintegrated. Of course, if you look at things like the Titanic, it's boots and buttons that will still be there. But what actually would survive so deep in the Pacific is paper. You can actually read papers in the Titanic. And I always think about what if you had, the fishing rod that
The
Fred
notes.
Noonan, the note, would the paper survive on the note? It might have. So those are my little fantasies of finding a plane. Like, wouldn't there be any information on? I think that there are quite a few people who thought that they would, in their lifetime, have the mystery solved. I don't know if it will be in our lifetime, but I think the chances are getting better by the year.
I want to ask you something that I think is just fun to talk about. President Trump released the JFK files, and there was this big thing. And JFK, for me, is it's a big deal because as this comes out, we are going to be releasing our new show, Investigation History, and we're going to do a 10-part series on JFK. So we're neck deep in JFK right now, pre-research for that and interviews and stuff. But what I want to ask you is, I know that Les Kinney has filed 200 plus FOIAs over the years. I know dozens and dozens and dozens of people from Elgin Long, all the way. I mean, everybody in the case, for the most part, that's deep researching, has filed some kind of FOIA, and everything has been shut down. My question to you is, would you support a complete FOIA release for the Earhart files? And if there were a release of the Earhart files, what do you think we'd find?
First of all, Here's an odd story. During the pandemic, I live in New York City and I was walking across bridges, just to get some exercise, And on one of my first walks, I was talking to this man who claimed to be an intelligence officer, and I thought he was just BSing me. And about 3 days later, like boxes of files came to my apartment. Which, so I had looked at a lot of stuff, but I don't think there's any there. I don't really know what you're talking about that you think is going to be revealed. I think if anything, I think you'd be really surprised that George Putnam has a very long history to an early form of the FBI. Like when you get people arrested, it's because of his relationships. The FBI looked very different. I mean, that's what Killers of the Flower Moon is about. But he was in an anti-vice unit in New York with Milton Raley, and that was his military service. He was an undercover guy. I mean, people don't realize that. I don't really think you're going to find anything. I really think that, I mean, Chris, I really think that they're going to find the plane. The thing is, the Pacific is not, I'm telling you what you already know, but the Pacific is not the Atlantic, right? The Pacific is so deep. And even if you search a massive area, it's like I said that with my New York accent, a massive area. It's like a pinprick. But one of the things I have been explained to by the Nauticus team, who I think are really top notch, right? Just because they don't find Amelia doesn't mean that that research isn't valid, because then you can eliminate where she's not, right? And if you think about it, the Titanic was not found immediately. Shackleton's ship was not found immediately. You eliminate places. And I really believe that the plane went down. I think it was empty, out of gas. Whether or not she was alive for a while, or I mean, that's beyond my pay rate. But I will say that I do think it's probably within 11 miles of Howland Island. And I do think that they'll find it. I mean, I just think it's going to be found. Even though I think the Romeo brothers are lovely, I've met them, right? I didn't think at the time that that was her plane, because I was talking to other people that were telling me it was probably a rock.
Yeah, we had a lot of those folks that were saying that, hey, when they announced it, when Tony first came on the show and they sort of talked about the sonar image initially, there was a lot of folks that obviously were telling me that, hey,
Not
not
so
so
fast.
fast. Like, let's wait until we actually have like legitimate photos and not a sonar image. And yeah, it turns out, a pile of rocks, which, as Tony mentioned, a very cruel trick of irony.
Here's the thing about that, and I've been told this by all the people searching for Amelia Earhart, is that it's good business for them too to not say anything too negative about their rivals, because it helps fund their expeditions, right? So it's about the money again. But I do think that technology is getting better and better. I think it would be a great day that it happens. I was interviewed for that article, and I did say I didn't think it was her plane, but they took that bit of the line out.
Well, I was interviewed for that too, and don't feel bad. They cut me out of the whole thing in its entirety. So but she was very lovely though.
But I will say that the brothers are delightful people. That's a truth. I sort of lean towards Nauticus. That would be my money. If I was a betting woman, I'm not going to find her. But I do think I found a lot of things that no one else will have ever known unless I did the research that I did. I think that if it's found, we're all going to have a drink.
Yes, I think so. Maybe two or three or 10.
But I do think that that's a fascinating aspect, is if they found the plane, if it might be one or two pieces in my mind, as it's been explained to me by Team Nauticus. I do think it's so fascinating that people have ideas of like skeletons being found. No, that would have dissolved. None of that would be there. But again, metal boots and paper.
Not surprising to me, but I mean, surprising to someone, in general that maybe doesn't understand how underwater deterioration works over time and different nautical environments and things of that nature. But yeah, paper would be one of the things that might survive depending where in the world this aircraft lies as we speak. So yeah, that's very compelling.
Right. One other thing that I will say is that one thing I want to really tell you is that, and maybe you disagree with me, but I don't think there's any credence at all to Amelia Earhart having been have come back. There's a lot of stories like that. I was slipped a lot of video. I've listened to a lot of audio that no one has listened to. I think that's part of it, again, goes back to raising attendance.
Yeah.
at museums.
Yeah, museums selling books. Yeah, absolutely,
Selling
right?
books.
Yeah.
And I just believe in going where the facts lie. I don't have any enemies in this world about this. I was just really interested in finding out what I found out. And I was really, really hoping that I would still like Amelia Earhart at the end of the book. And I do.
Spoiler alert, she still does, folks. So that's we can get that out of the way. Okay, Lori, last question of the night.
Sure.
And this is just personal thoughts on this. I do want to ask you, because I faced it myself and I continue to face it every day, are you ready for, I don't want to say backlash is a bad term, but are you ready for the emails and the contacts and the phone calls and the folks calling you, telling you that, oh, you got it all wrong and this is why and all that stuff? Does that concern you, or does that take us all the way back to the beginning when you sort of stated, hey, this is a black and white story here. We have to tell it, and that's basically it. That's my job. Does that bother you, sort of the post release of the book, or do you not really even think about
Well, I mean, I was used to that with it. When you write about Antarctica, you get the same
that? Yeah,
thing.
that's true.
But I mean, that's one of the reasons I went to Antarctica was because I wanted to be able to say, "Hey, look, I'm really going all in." I think I have about 30 pages of footnotes.
Yeah.
If there's anything that anyone is questioning, you can check it out yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that people are up against are people that put things on the internet. That's just not true.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And people don't know, they don't discern. Another thing, this is my pet peeve as a, I teach journalism. Remember, I'm a professor of
Yeah.
journalism. Here's a problem that a lot of people don't talk about. Sometimes people will interview experts on Amelia Earhart and they're not vetting the experts. This person knows what they're talking about. And they don't realize that this person might have a spotty
Yeah.
history,
Yeah.
right? So you have to also vet your
Yeah.
sources. Does this person have a long history of bullshit? You know, is this person someone who's very valid? And is there anything at stake for the person telling you the story? Is this person trying to make money in any way because of what they're telling you?
Yeah.
That's a big question as a journalist. It doesn't mean that they're always lying,
Yeah.
but you start to understand why someone doesn't want you to say something. Again, sometimes it's as simple as legacy that they want to protect family legacy. Sometimes they're raising money for an expedition that's also cutting them a salary.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things like that going on. Amelia Earhart gets you in the tent. She raises money. I mean, I got a not small advance for this book,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, bigger than my other books, partly because of who I am and I hope my track record, but also because it's Amelia Earhart.
Sure.
Everybody wants to happen to Amelia Earhart,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm completely innocent on this, but the thing that I would never do is put a book out in the world without all my footnotes that anyone that doubts, hey, this wasn't said on tape. Hey, here's where you can listen to the tape. Here's where you could find this document. At the end of the day, you're going to get people telling you different stories. I just told you something that most people don't know. That letter that you mentioned before is a real letter.
Yeah.
Amelia Earhart really did write a letter to her would-be husband the night before. That's an extraordinary. And I've been to Nohant where it was written. I've actually been to all through the files there, but it wasn't written the way it's been printed in the New York Times.
Right.
I mean, New York Times is the paper of record, you know, so you have to dig deeper, right? If somebody's telling you something and it's an extraordinary claim, they need extraordinary proof.
Jesus.
And that's what journalism is. Anything else is shoddy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I ask you, not you, Chris, but the collective you, the listeners of
Sure.
this podcast, to think, what does this person have at stake who's telling the story? Is there money to be made? That's always a big red flag.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll end on that. As I said earlier, we could go all night here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the book is The Aviator and the Showman, Amelia Earhart, George Putnam, and the Marriage That Made an American Icon. It releases worldwide on July 15th. I will probably see you at the Amelia Earhart Festival this year.
Absolutely, I'm coming in. I want to say one thing that I think anyone who's listening to this would love to know.
Yeah.
I did get a good advance. I haven't hidden from that,
Yeah.
but I spent a lot of that money on getting photo rights to photos that no one has ever seen before.
Yeah.
There are 60 photos in the book as well, and some of them are extraordinary photos that are going to really make you rethink this story, including pictures of the aforementioned sugar daddy
Yeah.
and pictures of Amelia Earhart's other boyfriends that we don't know about,
Yeah.
and pictures of George Putnam's shenanigans, is one way to put it, after Amelia Earhart died.
Yeah.
Some shocking photos there, and his shenanigans before Amelia Earhart died. It's very difficult to be able to have the kind of money that you need to clear photos in this world.
Yeah.
So I felt that was a gift to readers.
Yeah.
My husband thrilled that I
Man.
spent a lot of money, but I really, really wanted people to pick up the book and say, wow, not only is the writing here good and the research here really good, but the photos are just going to knock your socks off.
Well, Lori, it's been a pleasure. I've said this before. I've said it publicly a couple times. I will say it again. Fred Gerner was a number one book that was in 1966. I think we got another one. I really do.
I hope that you're right. That would be so exciting. But I will
Yeah.
look forward to seeing you in person in Kansas. And I hope anyone is listening to this, if they're in town for the Amelia Earhart Festival, to come say hi. And I'm also going to be on a very big book tour
Yeah.
about the United States and maybe Canada. And so if anyone is listening, please come up to me and say hello and bring your book and I'll autograph it and we'll have a conversation.
Yes, absolutely. We will link everything we spoke of in the show notes tonight. I can't wait for the book. You have a very captive audience for this show, certainly, who's going to be swooping up those copies and reading, consuming the book very rapidly. And I'm sure they're going to have a lot of questions. I'm hoping that this podcast will help clarify some of those questions before they're even asked, sort of as the book is released. Lori, it's a pleasure to know you, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me on. I always listen to the podcast.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.